Good evening and welcome, dear friends. It's so good to see all of you here this evening as we gather again in wondering and possibility. So we join together in our shared intention to listen intently, to reflect on the meaning of what we are receiving, to review our own intention each week, and to explore the possibilities of Christianity, perhaps expressed in new ways. May a word of grace this evening come to each one of us. And so we begin in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, God transcendent, God omnipresent, God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity, in whom we live and move and have our being. So this evening, we're going to approach our time of remembrance a little differently. As you know, we often begin by speaking of someone in our lineage that has given much, that has made an enormous difference in our own lives and in the teachings that we wish to take in and understand and embody. But tonight, and rather than honoring a person, because our email today spoke of the Psalms, and the morning liturgy began by speaking of the Psalms in a meaningful way, I thought we would begin by reflecting upon what an enormous blessing the Psalms were. For they actually were the teachings and prayers that Jesus uttered during his time. Who were the ones or ones who wrote these prayers that explore the range of the human heart so carefully, so reverently? And then they were passed down to us from age to age. In fact, to the utmost bounds of the world. And I see that my own image is rather hazy. So what I'm going to do is stop the video for just a moment and turn it back on, and sometimes that clears up. Ah, it did. Okay, so when we think of the Psalms were handed on to us over these thousands of years, without benefit of a printing press, much less all of the technologies and medias that we have today. So let us listen to the psalm that was uttered in the morning liturgy today from the great Psalm 19. The heavens proclaim the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth the work of God's hands. Day unto day takes up the story, and night unto night makes known the message. No speech, no word, no voice is heard, yet their span extends through all the earth, their words to the utmost bounds of the world. There is a tent that has been placed for the sun. It comes forth like a bridegroom coming from his tent, rejoices like a champion to run its course. At the end of the sky is the rising of the sun. To the furthest end of the sky is its course. There is nothing concealed from its burning heat. May we, like St. Paul, give thanks to God unceasingly and receiving the word and hearing it and receiving it, not as a human word, but as it truly is, the word of God, which is now at work in us. May we have ears to hear. So before we enter into our time of centering and Lectio Divina, just a word If you are going to be present in person at the reception after the Sunday service, Douglas Christie has graciously consented to have a book signing for us. So if you own one of his books and care to bring it, I'm sure that he would be very pleased to accommodate you and sign the book personally for you. So now we prepare ourselves to collect our being, to begin to see, to work on the side of knowledge, and to experience this knowledge on the side of being. We do so quietly, opening our minds to hear what is ours to hear at this time, and opening our hearts to value what we hear. This matters to our very selves, for one another, for the world. We place ourselves with intention and immanent trust and receptivity to the influences that are coming to us from the circle of all conscious humanity, and we prepare to awake to them, to consciously receive them. With back upright, heart opened, mind quiet, in direct attention, body relaxed, noticing perhaps and then releasing tension, constriction, resistance. We breathe in deeply every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything. Everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, all affirming, all denying, and we hold it as offering, reconciled, as food for being. We lift it. Ask that it all be transubstantiated in our being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God, as we ourselves are beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world. All worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and the small fears of my heart. I open to the divine human life that has been gifted to me. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. So now we enter into the time of Lectio Divina. Our passage will be read three times, with silence in between each reading. We can't help but thank God for you because your faith is flourishing and your love for one another is growing. Keep a watchful eye on your thoughts. If you've come with a novice's enthusiasm and can't accomplish what you want, take every chance you can find to sing the psalms in your heart. Don't give up. Above all, realize that you are in God's presence. Hold your heart there in wonder. Empty yourself completely. Sit waiting. Keep your practice, and your practice will keep you. Persevere. Connect word and deed, faith and action, being and doing. And during this time of social and cultural darkness, may we remember that the effects of Benedict's founding insights and of their institutional embodiment by those who learned from them were, from the standpoint of the ages, quite unpredictable. Ours, too, is a time of waiting for new and unpredictable possibilities of renewal and evolution. We can't help but thank God for you because your faith is flourishing and your love for one another is growing. Keep a watchful eye on your thoughts. If you've come with a novice's enthusiasm and can't accomplish what you want, take every chance you can find to sing the psalms in your heart. Don't give up. Above all, realize that you are in God's presence. Hold your heart there in wonder. Empty yourself completely. Sit waiting. Keep your practice, and your practice will keep you. Persevere. Connect word and deed, faith and action, being and doing. And during this time of social and cultural darkness, may we remember that the effects of Benedict's founding insights and of their institutional embodiment by those who learned from them were, from the standpoint of the ages, quite unpredictable. Ours, too, is a time of waiting for new and unpredictable possibilities of renewal and evolution. We can't help but thank God for you because your faith is flourishing and your love for one another is growing. Keep a careful eye on your thoughts. If you've come with a novice's enthusiasm and can't accomplish what you want, take every chance you can find to sing the psalms in your heart. Don't give up. Above all, realize that you are in God's presence. Hold your heart there and wonder. Empty yourself completely. Sit waiting. Keep your practice, and your practice will keep you. Persevere. Connect word and deed, faith and action, being and doing. And during this time of social and cultural darkness, may we remember that the effects of Benedict's founding insights and of their institutional embodiment by those who learn from them were, from the standpoint of the ages, quite unpredictable. Ours, too, is a time of waiting for new and unpredictable possibilities of renewal and evolution. And may it be so. So I'd like to invite you to share what you received from the readings of this passage, perhaps from gazing on the image. Perhaps someone would care to share that hasn't for a while. First, Jim, good evening. Welcome.
Yes, good evening. I think what caught my attention in this time of holy remembering was, I guess it's been 20, 25 years ago that we're reading the Rule of Benedict. I believe Joan Chittister was the author. And that impressed me so much and had such an influence on me that I think for about 6 or 7 years, that was one of my daily readings. Mm-hmm. And it was so impressive that I think when I also was reading A Cloud of Unknowing, and that was written, I believe the Rule of Benedict was written probably 1,500 years ago. But it was so interesting how relevant that in these times, those rules still are. So I would certainly encourage, if you've never seen those or been able to, and I think Joan Chittister did such a great job of making it to this era. So it really blessed me, and yes. I'm hoping that everybody, if you haven't read it, it definitely would be something that those rules can be applied to today also.
Absolutely, they can. And her particular book is a very accessible one and relevant one. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm going to call on Pam. Yes, good to see you, Pam. It's been a while since we've heard from you.
Good to see you, Marianne. Good evening. What struck me was this being a time of change, of evolution, and what inspires me every day in my practice is knowing all of the people around the world who are practicing. My friends at CCH, but my friends back in Alpine, but my friends who are of other traditions who have a silent practice and are very dedicated to it as much or more so than we are. And it makes me reflect on Deborah's presentation on Sunday about, you know, we are the light of the world. And this has been true for thousands of years, that those we tiny, tiny dots of light have really held this planet, and we continue to do so. And what a wonderful responsibility, but also a privilege to do this. And I just, I'm just in awe of that. So thank you.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. Thank you, Pam. Mm-hmm. So Steve or Kathy are both. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, it is Kathy. So here I am. What jumped out at me is the and I wrote it down in my notes, keep a watchful eye on your thoughts. I feel like that really is almost a daily remembrance for me, because I think when you're on your spiritual journey, you have we have the knowledge that there's all kinds of thoughts you can choose to have, and you can direct your thoughts to feelings that keep you better connected to our source. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's exactly what I took when I read that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you. That's mm-hmm. so true. Thank you, sure. Kathy. Sure. So Jill and Jeff. Jill.
I heard unpredictable possibilities. And I heard that in such a hopeful light. And it connected with when the early monastic fathers and Benedict put out these practices, it seemed unpredictable of what it would be like when institutionalized and spread. And yet they were basing it on their personal experience. So they knew it had happened within them, and they were sharing that. And it gives me great hope that we are all coming to that experiential knowledge that everything they said is actually predictable. It works when we keep our practice keeps us. When above all, we remember God, then there is a predictable response that arises, and it's really love. And so hopeful that amidst what seems to be very unpredictable times, if we continue and the practices spread, there is hope.
Yes. Amen. Thank you, Jill. Thank you. So we'll do Catherine and then Lisa, and then we'll close this part of our evening. Catherine, welcome.
Good evening, everybody. What jumped out at me was, above all, realize you were in God's presence and hold your heart there in wonder. And, you know, I remember studying the Benedict rule, and I believe he was cooking and wasn't good at it, and he just had to keep doing it with the love of God in his presence. So and that idea of just being in wonder that comes from the godly play is just such a way of being that if I'm reminded above all to realize that, then I am fed.
I thank you, Catherine. Thank you indeed. So Lisa, good evening.
Hi, Mary Ann. I heard what Kathy heard, to keep a careful eye on your thoughts. And it reminds me that our thoughts do create a reality. and that our being draws our life. So it is of the utmost importance to keep a careful eye on those thoughts and how that manifests in life. And then also I heard keep your practice, and I also heard 5 minutes more.
Oh, and amen. Good.
Yeah. I'm all in, Marianne.
Yeah, I know you are, Lisa. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. It's been a long time. Yes, thank you so much. Well, what a delight to my heart to see all of you and to know the rest of you are here too, all of us together. And it is with a bit of excitement, I must say, that I'm very pleased to introduce Peter, who will then introduce our special guest, Douglas Christie, and we'll see what the Spirit is going to bring to us this evening. So first, welcome, Peter. Good evening.
Good evening, Marianne, and good evening, everyone. We're in for a treat, and I picked up Douglas this afternoon at the airport, and that was the first time I met Douglas in person. Earlier this year, I reached out to Douglas by way of an email at his college that he teaches at, and I was hopeful that that email would somehow find him, and it did, and he generously responded and was very open to the idea of discussing coming to visit the church. And that alone says a lot about the man, that he was willing to take an email out of the blue like that and discern together. What I want to say by way of introduction tonight is that in my view, Douglas Christie is a generational voice. And like many men who reach their prime, and women as well, but they reach that prime where the years and years of study and teaching come together with their being. Mm-hmm. And they are able to give to the world something that's more than knowledge and something that's more than wisdom. I think a community like the Church of Conscious Harmony can grow in humility to say we need to understand our monastic spiritual tradition more deeply. And one way you can do that is just by getting a hold of his masterpiece, The Word in the Desert, published by Oxford University Press. This was his first book. I believe it's his dissertation, but I'm not sure on that. The subtitle says it all, Scripture and the Quest for Holiness in Early Christian Monasticism. Another way of saying that, the quest for holiness is the journey of self-transformation or the journey of self-development. There's a lot of parallels between the work and the early monastics in the desert. But to understand the tradition and to understand the power of the word of the desert, fathers and mothers, and the scriptures, the role of the scriptures, would be very useful for all people on this journey. And I commend you that book. Then came this extraordinary masterpiece called The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, and he gets the first prize for best titles of books, for sure. Blue Sapphire of the Mind. This book integrates contemplative spirituality and theology and Christian mysticism with the overall theme of understanding the role of the earth and our ecology, a contemplative ecology. But it's not just about the earth. Part of his brilliance is weaving together the monastic wisdom with practical issues and personal stories. That was an extraordinary book, but then came a couple of years ago, this book. And when this book came out, I said, this man has to meet the Church of Conscious Harmony community, because this book is a masterpiece. It's a modern masterpiece. It speaks to so many aspects of what the Church of Conscious Harmony is interested in. But whereas Bernadette Roberts' teaching was a masterpiece of the experiential spiritual journey, what Douglas Christie is giving is a masterpiece of the spiritual tradition and the history, not just the dry history, but the living history of Christian spirituality grounded in mysticism and obviously shaped and formed by the monastic experience. One of the things I most respect about Douglas Christie, and I don't know him personally very well at all, but just through knowing him by way of his stories in the books, is that he is a living the monastic way you know, he appreciates visiting monasteries and has deep relationships with several monasteries, as best I can understand. And that is a person of practice. So he's a generational voice. He's a generous man, a caring man. He's a good man. And I could feel that goodness. The second we had our first Zoom conversation, I said, this is a good man. This is an Abba. This is an Abba for monks in the world. And he's a God man more than anything that comes through. A big God, not the small God, but the big God that fits for all sorts of different perspectives. And I think that's something very much we can admire. You never know a person's stature when you're talking on the screen. And so when I got out of the car and saw him today for the first time, he reminded me, I'm not kidding, of Thomas Keating's stature and Joseph Boyle's stature. I thought it was Joseph Boyle for a second. And that just was heartening for me, because I wish more than anything for the Church of Conscious Harmony to have good Abbas grounded in the deep tradition of Christian spiritual life who can be an upstream source for this community. And so it is with great joy that I have the privilege of introducing Douglas Christie. Welcome to Austin. I pray you sleep deeply and that you rest well and that you are inspired by this church and community. Welcome, Douglas.
Peter, thank you. Wow, what a beautiful introduction, and from the heart, I just felt that so deeply. I really appreciate it. And I could say the same thing to you, that the first moment we met online, I felt your essential goodness and depth of spirit. So I really feel like this has been a providential meeting for me, and I'm so grateful for it. I'm also grateful to be here. I'm actually in Austin, of course, because we're meeting this way. Nobody really knows where anyone is. It's kind of the funny thing that we learned through COVID, that we could gather and kindle community in this way, that it feels on one level, of course, a little disembodied. It's a digital medium. And yet, as I just experienced the last 20 minutes, it can become a beautiful space of prayer as well. And I certainly experienced that during the years of COVID, and I suspect this community did as well. I really am grateful to be able to share with you tonight, tomorrow night, and Saturday, some of what the desert tradition has meant to me. And I had to smile a little bit when Peter said he really, that I, from his perspective, really love the monastic tradition. Well, it's true, I do. And then he added, he likes to go to monasteries. And that made me laugh. And that's also true. But not, I hope, as a tourist, but as a pilgrim. And ever since this monastic tradition got inside of me, you know, so many years ago when I was in my early 20s, really, it touched something in me. It touched something of my own spiritual longing. And I found myself drawn to such places with the hope that I myself could go deeper. And in fact, I found teachers, I found friends, men and women. And then I began to find something just as miraculous, which is that while this life is being lived in a particular way within monasteries, it's also something much more widely shared by so many of us who feel called to the contemplative life. And so it gave me something that I've carried with me my entire life, and I'm carrying with me now. And I'm not a monk myself. I live amidst the happy chaos of family living. I'm married. I have 5 children who come and go at various hours. They're mostly grown now, but that doesn't stop the coming and going, not at all. And what a practice that is. What a practice that is. and anyone in this gathering this evening who has children in their lives can testify to that. It's where the practice really takes hold. So I just offer you that context before beginning, and also just to say how grateful I am to be here and for the invitation. I'm going to share my screen and perhaps if someone can just give me the heads up that it's visible. Yes, thumbs up. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. So tonight, as a way of introducing myself and also getting to know you, I want to invite you into the desert and to consider what it means to enter the desert. This will not be a brand new question for most of you. It might be a question you've been living with for much of your life. I sense the deep integrity of this community and how carefully you attend to the contemplative call. But the desert is just endless in its depth, its beauty, its expanse, its breadth, its mystery. And we can all, I think, benefit from pausing and asking ourselves, what does it mean? What might it mean in this moment to enter the desert? So a few thoughts to begin. And these are thoughts that I think the tradition cherishes very deeply. It means entering the depths. We heard a beautiful psalm this evening, and the monastic tradition has really devoted itself to listening deeply to these psalms. And these are two verses from the psalms that resonated so profoundly for the monks, because it spoke to the question of what it might mean to open ourselves to the depth in us, that's also the depth of God in us. And this text from Psalm 42, deep calls to deep. The word in the Septuagint there, the Greek word is abyssos, from which we get abyss. The abyss calls to the abyss. This is an emblem of our longing for God that became very, very important to the early Christian monks and remains important to us as a marker of the depth that we're capable of realizing in ourselves, in our lives. And this prayer of Psalm 130 has also resonated across the ages. We pray this when we don't know what else to say. This is a prayer that often surfaces at funerals and at other very significant moments of passage in our lives when we are truly lost for words and we call out to God from our depths, even if we can't say all that's in our hearts. So this, I think, is where we begin. And you'll discover as we think about the desert together these days that the desert is often seen as its own kind of mysterious place, but it's often interchangeable with the abyss or with the night or with the oceanic. These are all images that kept surfacing in the Christian contemplative tradition. And so the desert is a place to enter the depths. I think it's important to listen to the voices of the men and women who went out into the deserts of Egypt and Asia Minor, the Judean desert, the Syrian deserts in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. Amma Syncletica was one such important teacher. And there are so many of these beautiful sayings that come out of the tradition of the Apophthegmata or the sayings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. And like we saw this evening with the practice of Lectio, sometimes it's enough just to chew on one of these sayings. It'll keep you going for quite a while. And but I wanted to share this one as a way to begin this evening also because Ama Syncletica really touches into the heart of the matter. There's all sorts of questions that surface in the desert literature about what's the meaning of this life? What am I doing here? What am I missing? What's the point of it all? And this is what Ama Syncletica says. For those who are making their way to God, there is at first great struggle and effort, but then indescribable joy. For just as those who wish to kindle a fire are at first choked with the smoke, suffer watery eyes, and in this way achieve their purpose, indeed, Scripture says, our God is a consuming fire, so we too must kindle the divine fire within us with tears and effort. This teaching captures so much of what is emblematic of the early desert tradition. Yes, there is struggle and effort. Anyone who begins along this path will feel that as you contend with yourself, maybe old habits, maybe thought streams and anxieties that you can't quite seem to shake. And you have to stay with that in the company of others, community, a teacher. Then she says, indescribable joy. This is what the life is about. This is what is waiting to surface in our lives. And it's a kindling of a fire within us. There's something waiting to combust within us if we can only give it our attention. So here's a vision of Christian contemplative life that is an invitation to become alive in the fire of God. It's a beautiful vision. I don't know about you, but I find the wisdom that helps me comes from many different places, including the New Yorker. This little cartoon, while whimsical, also packs a little bit of a punch, especially relating to our endless desire to find the purpose in everything and to determine why it is we're doing what we're doing, what the meaning of it is, what the outcome will be, what we'll get from it, purpose, utility. We find ourselves, I think, sometimes trapped by this endlessly. And here are these two devoted fellows, one an elder, one a novice, perhaps. And you can, of course, imagine the implied question that the younger one just put to the older one. Father, what happens next after we finished all of this? Nothing happens next. This is it. Nothing happens next. This is it. Of course, we say, we laugh, we smile. How many times do we have to learn this lesson? Returning to the present moment, cherishing the present moment, allowing ourselves to become alive in the present moment in the presence of God. Nothing happens next. This is it. One more place to begin warming our thoughts together. There's so many places in our lives where we can find ourselves unexpectedly called to go deeper. Art, poetry, film, music, also encounters with other human beings that kind of open us up to ourselves in ways that are surprising to us we began to think about things differently as a result of this. Philip Levine is a wonderful California poet. He's originally from Detroit, working class Jewish family, worked on the assembly lines in the auto factories, had grease under his fingers constantly, eventually moved out to the Central Valley of California. And he's a poet who takes the time and trouble to look at things carefully. This poem relates something that his wife told him, that he then ended up sitting with and mulling over and then giving voice to in his own way. And it also kind of raises a question for all of us when we're thinking about the root meaning of contemplation is to see, or to see deeply into. And it often has a religious meaning, which means to behold the divine. But what we are often invited to notice, I think, is that everything in our lives can become an opportunity for seeing deeply into. And the thing that I find great about this poem, by the way, this is just one part of a 7-part epic poem on dust. And so in case you want to follow it up later and have all 7 parts of it, but we all have, I think, a working sense of what is worthy of our gaze and beneath which we may not want to go. You might think that the tree is worthy of your gaze, or these beautiful hills around Austin are worthy of your gaze, or the person you're sitting with sharing a cup of coffee, certainly worthy of your gaze. What about a rock that appears on the road before you? What about a mote of dust? We all have standards, don't we? That's way too insignificant to call for our attention. And here's Philip Levine giving it his full attention. My wife tells me that when she was 6, she came home from school to an empty house, put down her lunchbox, sat on a hassock by her father's chair, and simply waited. Someone known would return home soon, she was sure. The house was still, silent, holding its breath. The late afternoon sunlight streamed in the unshaded windows and turned the dust into tiny golden planets floating before her. 64 years later, she declares, it was beautiful, and goes on to describe the sense of awe and peace before this vision of the universe that descended from nowhere, or perhaps rose from within. North Central Iowa, 1933, her grandmother's house. Nothing else remains of the day. She gazes into space, seeing again those whirling worlds more perfectly than the room she's in, her smile open, her glazed eyes radiant. It was beautiful, she says, and goes on to describe the sense of awe and peace before this vision of the universe that descended from nowhere, or perhaps rose from within. We're invited in to an experience of interiority here, a beautiful, simple experience of a child that stayed with her entire life. And later she shared it to her husband, who was so taken by what she shared that he gave voice to it in his own way. Where are these moments emerging in our lives? These moments of kindling of awareness, the potential for seeing deeply into is there in every next moment of our lives, if we have eyes to see. So tonight I'm opening up these questions. The fundamental question, what does it mean to enter the desert? And I want to invite you to think about it in three ways. There are more than this, but these are three ways with which we can begin. First of all, an actual place with a distinctive history and a particular ecological and cultural depth and richness. Spiritual folks are sometimes in danger of becoming a little disembodied in their relationship to particular things, and metaphors of desert experience arise out of desert places. So we're invited, I think, to take that seriously and to consider the concreteness of the desert. What does it mean to enter the desert as an inner landscape comprised of silence, stillness, struggle, and emptiness, but also, as Amma Sincletica reminds us, unexpected joy? What does it mean to open ourselves to that vast inner landscape? And how can the desert become incorporated into a meaningful spiritual practice? For our own sakes, yes, but also for the sake of our fragile but still beautiful world. What kind of desert practices are we being invited into? So the desert is a place. Let's think about these different ways of approaching it. Mary Austin is a California writer from the early part of the 20th century who made her home in the Owens Valley. It's on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it's where the desert meets the mountains. It's a very rich and unusual desert landscape with its own complex ecology and habitat. She wrote about it beautifully in a book called The Land of Little Rain, and I want to just read this passage from Land of Little Rain to give a little sense of what it means to be of a place, of a desert place. She says, "If one is inclined to wonder at first how so many dwellers came to be in the loneliest land that ever came out of God's hands, what they do there and why stay, one does not wonder so much after having lived there. None other than this long, brown land lays such a hold on the affections." So what is it to live there, to dwell there, to feel its power? And I'm not saying this evening that absorb the beauty and power of desert contemplative spirituality, you have to go hang out in the desert. But I am saying that entering into the actual endlessness of the deserts, especially that we have here in North America, can be a soul-stirring and life-changing experience and can open us to the mystical riches of the desert tradition in a new way. So then we move to another register altogether. In the Christian mystical tradition, and the idea emerges here among many of our finest mystical writers that God is a kind of desert. Of course, we're speaking metaphorically here. Of course, this is an analogy. It's a comparison, but it's the language that many mystics use to evoke the sense of who God is and how we can come to know God. This is from John Rusbrook, a Flemish mystic of the 14th century, his beautiful work, The Spiritual Espousals. He says, "The most high nature of the Godhead is simplicity and onefoldness, inaccessible height and bottomless depth, incomprehensible breadth and eternal length, a dark silence, a wild desert." Reading that, I wonder, do you feel the invitation of it? Do you feel it to be a bit forbidding and foreboding? I could say I feel both things reading it. It's very alluring to think of entering into relationship with this kind of immensity. And I think this is what Rusbrook and others were pointing to. we make God too small. God is endlessly immense and deep. A dark silence, a wild desert. And it's also true, in their audacity, the mystics were not afraid to push against our sense of what might be possible. We ourselves are a kind of desert, they would claim. Our created essence, which means like who we truly are, our deepest, truest level, is to be beheld as a wild waste desert wherein God lives. Waste here doesn't mean something to be thrown away. It means something endless, open, expansive. We ourselves are a desert. God is a desert. There's a kinship there that we feel. And Meister Eckhart takes this line of thinking to the next step, which is what we're always asking about in relation to the practice of our spiritual life. How do we acquire what he calls an inward desert? How do we enter this desert? What is the meaning of this for us? How can we learn to live in this vast, expansive space of God? And Eckhart says a person must learn to acquire an inward desert wherever and with whomever she is. She must learn to break through things and seize God in them and to make God's image grow within herself. Thus, a person should be pervaded with God's presence, transformed with the form of her beloved God, and made essential by God, so that God's presence shines for her without any effort. Rather, she will find emptiness in all things and be totally free of things. Eckhart has sometimes been, he's been admired and accused by different persons of being the most Buddhist of Christian mystics. His use of the language of emptiness and freedom sounds to our ears not unlike certain Buddhist teachings. And I think that's something interesting to consider. But here he is suggesting that we have the capacity to break through things and seize God in them. That is, not to be held by things, but to feel the radiant presence of the divine in and through them. And that we can be made essential. We can return to our true selves, our truest, deepest selves by God, and feel the presence of God shining within without any effort. This is what it means for Eckhart to acquire an inner desert. And one more voice from the Christian mystical tradition, Hadewijk of Antwerp, a 13th century Flemish mystic, who really is one of our boldest, kind of most courageous mystics. She wrote endlessly about the call to give ourselves to our beloved and recognized that this could be a tumultuous, painful process, opening ourselves to love. There's nothing romanticized about this in Hadewijk's work. It's a wholehearted, full-bodied openness to what love is asking of us in our lives. And she herself was, we think, banished from her community. She was a beguine. She lived much of her life in precarious conditions. And so she actually knew in her lived experience something of what it meant to be a wanderer and a vagabond. And this got transposed into some of her writings about her longing for God. She says, I do not complain of suffering for love. It is right that I should always obey her, for I can know her only as she is in herself. Whether she commands in storm or in stillness, this is a marvel beyond my understanding, which fills my whole heart and makes me stray in a wild desert. It is right that I should always obey her. She's speaking of her beloved and the power of love. It's an amazing kind of idea. And this call to become immersed in love is like being astray, says Hadovic, in a wild desert. So the questions we can consider together, we've already been touching on this. It's an actual place. It's a metaphor, but let's just go a little bit deeper into those questions. What is the desert and why go? I'll comment on some of these images occasionally, just so you know. This is an image from the high desert of Argentina, the Altiplano, where I traveled many years ago. It's really amazing to consider how many desert places there are in the world and how hidden most of them are. And yes, remote, hidden, but incredibly beautiful and compelling places. This is at 14,000 feet. So it is a place in the world, and I've already underscored this. It's not just a metaphor, it's an actual place. That's a good starting point. It's a vast open space, unknowable, unsayable. In the Christian mystical tradition, unknowability and unsayability are not seen as due to our limitations, but they are a sign of respect as we stand before an unknowable, unsayable mystery, the ineffability of our experience of God. The desert conjures that sense of unknowability and unsayability. It's a place of fierce beauty. My friend Gary Nabhan has written that in our common parlance or common imagination, desert is one of the few places in the world that tends to be defined by what it lacks. It lacks water, it lacks life, so we think. It's a place of lack. And although there is truth in the sense that there's vastness, the horizons are endless, the silence is so deep, it's a misnomer to speak of the desert as a place that is defined by lack. These are flamencos in a lake at 14,000 feet in the high desert of Argentina. This is where they live and nest and nurse their young. And this too is a desert place. There's endless life in the desert. And the deserts have their own distinctive ecological character, which I think we're invited to attend to and respond to. It's also immensely fragile. Several references were made earlier this evening to the disturbing times we're living through. It's true. It's so disturbing sometimes. You can hardly even bear to take it into your consciousness, into your soul. And this happened recently in the Eastern Mojave Desert, a place very beloved to me. A fire swept through. It's unheard of in this landscape, but it was a weather pattern that hadn't been seen not in living history that anybody could remember. And these precious, fragile Joshua trees, many thousands of them, were burned. And there's no clear sense of whether they will return, whether they will reseed, whether the habitat will allow for that. This too is part of what the desert is in our world today, and part of what I think we're invited to pay careful attention to. It's a place long inhabited by human beings. It can sound funny to say the desert has a history, but it does. It has a rich and varied history. In the Christian monastic tradition, everything begins from this place in the desert in Egypt, also the Judean desert, also Syria and Asia Minor. But here we have just a glimpse of where these desert teachings came from. They came from the lives of women and men who inhabited these particular desert places at a particular moment in history. And those of you who've encountered this literature before, you likely know this already, but the reason people went out into the desert in the fourth century in Egypt was in no small manner because it was a time of intense social, economic, and political crisis. The power of Rome was crushing ordinary people living up and down the Nile Valley. And so along with the spiritual hunger that motivated the monks, which is true, it's a very big part of what drew them to the desert, they were also trying to find a new way to configure society and community in a world that was increasingly dehumanizing. We recognize this in our own historical moment, what the meaning of flight to the desert might mean for us. It's also a place of deep cultural, spiritual value. This is a desert place, Quito Biquito Springs in Arizona, right along the Arizona-Mexico border. And it's a sacred place to the Tohono O'odham people. And being there, you can sense this, but to truly sense it, I think you have to be part of a culture that has had ceremonies for thousands of years that sees this as a pilgrimage site, that honors it as a place of origin of their people. So we don't think of the desert often as being a rich cultural, spiritual repository, but it is. It's a place where many of our deepest cultural, spiritual values are held and cherished. They're also being threatened. And this is also part of the Tohono O'odham Nation's challenge at the moment, is to deal with what's happened in the last several years with the building of the border wall, which has cut almost directly through sacred lands near Quito Biquito Springs. And so we're invited, I think, in relation to our own desert places, to think about the question of desecration. It's not just a ruined landscape, it's something deeper than that, something long held sacred by people who've lived on this continent being destroyed, taken away. And there is also the question of what happens almost every day in our deserts, from Texas to Arizona to California, human beings trying to make the passage. And so many of them not making the passage alive. It's almost too much to bear to think about what's happening. And for this evening, I don't even think it's helpful if we necessarily go into the details of how broken our immigration politics are in this country. They're totally broken. But it is worth our attention, I think, to consider the human lives that are being lost in this desert landscape. I do also want to call attention to something that for me is so encouraging. I met Alvaro Enciso not long ago, a Colombian who's come to live in Arizona. He's made it his life's work to plant a cross in the desert for every migrant trying to make the passage who has died in the desert. every single one, he's marking the place of their passing by erecting a cross. It's a sign of courage and hope and resiliency that I think can help us and encourage us and inspire us. So these are all very concrete elements of the desert. And I want to return to something that I noted earlier, which is that the desert is also and has for a long time been a rich and important metaphor for the inner life. Emptiness, stillness, vastness. These are all qualities of the desert and also qualities of our inner lives, or they can be. And perhaps we would say qualities of God. Depth, silence, mystery, struggle. Desert is not for the faint of heart. Transformation. And what emerges consistently out of the early desert monastic tradition is the power of love, the transforming power of love. It doesn't seem that way at first when you see women and men fleeing into wild solitary places. It doesn't feel very much like they're paying attention to what it means to be part of the human community. But what you begin to notice in that desert work is how carefully and deeply they're attending to what it means to open their own souls to love. And that leads them inevitably back into community and into the practice of love with their brothers and sisters. So why go to the desert? You may be asking yourself that right now. It's a funny question, though, because the way this sometimes works in practice is we don't necessarily go anywhere. Something comes to us. The desert may have already come to you. So it's a good question to ask whether you already have a relationship with the desert or whether you're being called to go deeper into the desert. You may determine, by the way, after these days that we have together, that you're not a desert person. That's fine. Maybe the ocean or the forest or the night is your image for going deeper. We don't need to be too insistent on this point, but it's a good question. Why go? Paul Bowles says it's because once we've found ourselves existing in the midst of the absolute, we can't help but go back again and again. It's too powerful. It's too alluring. It's too, it touches us too deeply to exist in the midst of the absolute. So I want to finish. I'll take a few more minutes and I'll just touch on some points. I probably will not read all these texts, but I'll be sharing this with everyone afterwards in any case, and you can take in what's meaningful for you. So you go to the desert to enter the vastness. We don't know why Jesus went out to the desert. The temptation narratives give a certain view of this, but there are many other instances as stripped down as this from Mark's gospel that indicate that he simply went out to this empty place to pray. It's one of the few artistic images we have of Christ in the desert. What did it mean that he gave himself so deeply and consistently to this work of entering the desert? And I want to maybe highlight here a rhythm or a relationship of the desert. This is a chance to improve your desert vocabulary if you're so inclined. The Greek is often quite interesting. Anachoresis means withdrawal into this place of silence or solitude, I want to suggest that anachoresis, askesis, and agape are all related as part of a desert rhythm. Sit in your cell and your cell will teach you everything, the monks taught. This is a radical teaching of not feeling that we always have to be running and going somewhere else or finding what we're seeking somewhere else. A beautiful invitation into silence and solitude and trusting that all the wisdom you're seeking will be found there. Askesis. This is maybe the next moment of the that Sinclair talked about in her saying the effort with tears that we make. The early desert literature, it can feel kind of awful to us. This is a detail from a painting of Matthias Grunewald, The Temptation of St. Anthony. Well, you go out into the desert and you enter that solitude and you begin to feel the presence of many things, old wounding thoughts, anxieties, sources of sadness, many things that are difficult for you to bear. And in the ancient tradition, they thought of this and they conceived of this as a kind of attack by these beings. And so we have the Temptation of St. Anthony and we have many, many, many renderings of this story. It resonated with people. We're struggling against principalities and powers in our desert solitude. And we must struggle, even if it's painful, even if it's difficult. And the psychology of this was also fascinating. The saying of Abba Abraham gives voice to this. He's asking about how the demons fight against him. And Poemen is a little incredulous at this. He says, the demons fight against you. Our own wills become the demons. And it is these which attack us in order that we may fulfill them. We can think of this humorously as in terms of the old cartoons with the good angel over on this shoulder, the bad angel over on this shoulder. Who are you going to listen to? We struggle with our own conscience, is what the desert monks are saying. And we can't always even discern what's the deepest, truest thing that we long for. This struggle is taking place within us. They were very respectful of this and very interested in this, and they gave it their full attention. But you emerge from this struggle, and again, this was their consistent testimony, you emerge from the struggle with a greater capacity to love, with a greater capacity to love. It's purifying, it's deepening. And they believe we are called into solitude, but they also believe that our life and death is with our neighbor. These two things sit side by side. And it's in solitude, the monks would say, that we learn what it is to love our neighbor. And I love this about the tradition, actually, that it holds these in tension. Another way to think of what the early men and women in the desert understood the desert life to be about was the idea of making an offering of yourself. Making an offering of yourself, your whole self, wholeheartedly. Amasyncletica puts it this way. To cultivate purity of heart. This is language of the desert tradition that has really endured in a beautiful way. John Cash in his conferences distinguishes between the ultimate end of our life, where we're truly moving or being drawn the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, but the proximate end, what we can give our attention to in the present moment, is purity of heart. Purity of heart. This is what we're being invited to cultivate every day of our lives. And Hesychia is also something that the monks were so intent on living into, stillness, a deep stillness that can come to characterize your entire life, a stillness where your awareness of the presence of God, your capacity to love your neighbor can become manifested. Stillness. Self-knowledge. Not a desert monk, of course, Nelson Mandela, but this is another thing that you begin to notice as you think about these questions. The wisdom that comes from sitting in your cell, it shows up in all kinds of different places in our culture. And I was so struck when I first read this. He was held in Robben Island as a prisoner for many, many, many years. And it was far from easy. And he suffered that imprisonment. And he came to feel, however, when he emerged back into his life and was given the challenge of leading his country, that that cell taught him so much about himself and about who he was and who he could be in the world. So this is not something just for the monks and nuns of old. It's something for all of us to think about in our world right now, how to draw upon that deepest inner truth of our beings so that we can be in the world in a healing way. We enter the desert to practice accompaniment. These beautiful women, little sisters of Jesus, I met them in Manila some years ago. I was there for a gathering. I'd been invited to participate of women and men, religious all over Asia. And they were part of the gathering, and we got into a conversation, and I asked them if they would take me to their place, and they did. And we spent a day walking around the neighborhood together, one of the worst slums in Manila, just abysmal poverty. And these particular nuns, followers of Charles de Foucault, a great desert mystic in the earlier part of the 20th century, they understand their desert calling to be something that invites them into the most abysmal places of suffering. And they live their life of the desert out almost always in urban landscapes, in the work of accompaniment of the most wretched and forgotten. I visited their place. There was just enough room for a place to cook, a place to sleep, and a place to pray. That was their life in this little hut in the middle of Manila. It really moved me to see them living out the desert in this way. And one more example of this, the monks of Tiberine in Algeria, who lived for many, many years in the work of accompaniment of their Muslim brothers and sisters, and who were caught up in the civil war in Algeria. They were kidnapped and murdered. They made a very difficult decision shortly before this happened to stay in Algeria. They voted as a community. They engaged in a careful process of discernment. Should we stay or should we go? And they chose to stay. And it came at a great cost. But what they felt about their lives in that place was that they had been called by God to accompany their brothers and sisters, not Christians. They were Muslims, very poor, forgotten by their own government. This was the life of the monk as they understood it, to accompany those who they've been given to live with in that place. It's a beautiful witness. And the last thing I'll say, and we'll stop here. We go to the desert, I think, to rekindle community. There's a beautiful note at the beginning of the Sayings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers that talks about the entire desert way of life as an invitation to participate in the common life. The Greek word here is koinonia. We already see this in the New Testament, of course, but the monks understood that what the desert was inviting them into was a common shared life of love. So how do we kind of begin to understand that paradox? It's a life of solitude, silence, of entering into vastness, beyond language, beyond concepts. It's getting lost, and yet it's also finding our way back to one another, to kindle the divine fire, to kindle love, to live in relationship with one another in the ground of our shared love. This is what I think it means to enter the desert. Thank you for your good attention. And we're just meeting one another tonight. So thank you for welcoming me. I think there's a little bit of time for comments or anything that anyone might want to say by way of response. I'm going to really depend on my hosts to help me navigate this part of the meeting. I would love to hear your thoughts. There was also the thought, if anyone is interested in this, Zoom has a chat function. And if you would find it easier or more meaningful to say something in the chat about what is moving in you in this moment, what's touching you, what's calling to you in these questions from this evening's time together, you could simply write it in the chat. And we have a raised hand, so we'll go with that. But I'll just invite everybody who's here, if you are so moved, to take a moment and write something in the chat. And then we'll just hear from the others. And I'm going to really depend on Marianne to facilitate. I think we're maybe close to time, but you can tell me how you wish to proceed. Yeah. I think Melva.
Okay. Thank you, Douglas. I wanted to share that reading your book on the insurmountable darkness of love, and hearing your talk tonight about the desert, I have to thank you, because I can't remember a time where, as I was reading the book, I would pause and literally just cry out loud. And what was touching me was that I haven't read much theology, but what I was struck with was the realness. And I don't think anybody in our community, I certainly can say that, you know, I'm 67 and I've been to the desert many times, but I've never read or had the opportunity, other than poetry or art or, you know, theater, that was able to get at that place in every human being where you confront the incomprehensible. Daily life gives us that opportunity. And I'm grateful that as a community, we get to face the reality of, you know, the pain of our lives, so that maybe we can, you know, like that it's a therapy, so that our souls can feel that we were courageous or brave or real enough, human enough to do it together, to potentially expand our capacities. I know it's hard for me. You know, I've had a lot of losses and I've had a lot of hurdles and a lot of deserts. And it's easier to compartmentalize and not have to remember or even go through that pain again. But I sensed the minute that I saw the announcement, and especially even contemplating the desert tonight, I feel like it's a must. I sense that it's going to cleanse me in a way that I've never been able to cleanse, because it'll be a group, but also just because you as a human being have the awareness of that, of how to find the beauty of our humanness is to go through this desert. I don't know if I'm saying it right. All I know is I'm grateful, and I'm grateful for the community that invited you here, and I'm willing to go to the desert.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And thank you, Douglas. If there are two people that we're past our time, but there are two people that have their hands raised, and if they're very, very brief, we can invite them to speak if you care to.
Hi, Douglas, thank you for a beautiful presentation. I'm sorry that I don't have my face here, but I have a very bad connection and I wish to keep that. I wanted to say that for me, the desert is a very spare place, and environmentally, it's very pared down. And that helps me to cut down and strip away different parts of my personality so that I can get to my essential essence. But at the same time, even the desert is full of sand or loam or clay or rock. And like the disillusionment that we can have in our heads, it's something that also has to be cleared away. There's a book by Kobo Abe called Women in the Dunes, and it's about a woman who's imprisoned in sand dunes, and every day she has to clear out the sand. And in the desert, that's what is so essential to my opening to God. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you all hear me okay with the wind?
Yes.
To be super brief, I just want to say the wholeness of me felt oriented in ways that not all of me feels on a whole level. And another way of putting it is I just felt very fathered today. Felt very spoken to. And I really appreciate that orientation bringing me together. Thank you for sharing very much.
You. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And thank you, Douglas. What a great blessing your presence is for us. And we look forward to being with you tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So we close our evening tonight with our night prayer of protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen.